2 Samuel chapter 15, and we're going to read, actually we're going to read the first 12 verses here. 2 Samuel 15, 1 through 12. And here it says, "After this it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses, and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision, that Absalom would call to him and say, 'What city are you from?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from such and such tribe of Israel.' Then Absalom would say to him, 'Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you.' Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice.' And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. In this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment." In other words, he schmoozed everybody. And so Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. And now it came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said to the king, "Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt at Geshur in Syria, saying, 'If the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord.' And the king said to him, 'Go in peace.' And so he arose and went to Hebron. And then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, 'As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron.' And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gileadite and David's counselor from his city, from Geloh, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number." Diane, would you ask a blessing, please? Amen. So if ever there was a man equipped to be a demagogue and to lead the people astray, that man would be Absalom. He was a handsome man, you know, and he was, that was a really good word to describe him, you know, because you know, as we look back in the last chapter, it talked about that very fact. The dictionary definition of demagogue is a person who appeals to the emotions and prejudices of people in order to gain power. And that's exactly what Absalom did. He had royal blood in his veins, not only from David, but actually from his mother's side as well. His grandfather was a king. And the fact that he had no moral character just wasn't important to the people. They were like sheep at this particular time. They'd follow anyone who told them what they wanted to hear and give them whatever they wanted to have. You know, that's just the way that it was going. Times haven't changed, have they? There was an old newspaper editor by the name of H.L. Minkins, and he had a definition of what a demagogue is. "One who preaches doctrine he knows untrue to men who knows to be idiots." And I think that we're seeing a lot of that in our day as well. Absalom was not only a consummate liar, but he was also a patient man who was able to discern just the right time to act. This didn't just happen overnight. He waited literally 2 years to have Amnon murdered, and he waited for 4 years before he rebelled against his father and seized the throne. So when you read the Psalms of David that he wrote during this particular time, it could be that at that time David was ill, and maybe that's why he didn't you know, have his hands totally involved with the affairs of the kingdom, and that's maybe why he was so able to be able to take it from David so easily. We know from Psalms 38 that David did experience an illness at one time because of the sins that he had committed. And listen to what it says in Psalms 38, 1 through 14, a psalm of David, to bring to remembrance, O Lord, do not rebuke me in your wrath, nor chasten me in your hot displeasure. For your arrows pierce me deeply, and your hand presses me down. There is no soundness in my flesh because of your anger, nor any health in my bones because of my sin. For my iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me. My wounds are foul and festering. So you kind of get a picture of what's going on with him. Because of my foolishness, I am troubled. I am bowed down greatly. I go mourning all the day long, for my loins are full of inflammation. I know a lot of scholars believe that David probably had some kind of venereal disease. That may be what's caused this. And there is no soundness in my flesh. I am feeble and severely broken. I groan because of the turmoil of my heart. Lord, all my desire is before you, and my sighing is not hidden from you. My heart pants. My strength fails me. As for the light of my eyes, it also is gone from me. My loved ones and friends stand aloof from my plague, and my relatives stand afar off. And those who seek my life lay snares for me. And I'm no doubt speaking of Absalom. Those who seek my hurt speak of destruction and plan deception all the day long. But like a deaf man, do not hear. And I am like a mute who does not open his mouth. Thus I am like a man who does not hear and whose mouth is no response. So again, it kind of makes you think. If David, again, if he was ill, no doubt this would give Absalom an opportunity to move in and to take over. So this egotistical prince used every device at his disposal to basically to mesmerize the people and to win their support. And he used a lot of flattery. And again, David had won the hearts of the people through sacrifice and service because he was a mighty warrior. But Absalom did it the easy way by manufacturing an image of himself that the people could not resist. David was a hero. Absalom was only a celebrity, though. He didn't have the credentials David did. People had become accustomed to their king and began to take him for granted. Now that Absalom had been reconciled with his father David, he was basically free to move around freely and to go where he wanted and whenever he wanted. Again, his first move was to begin to get for himself chariots, which were accompanied by 50 men who had, you know, aligned themselves with him to be his personal bodyguards. And they also took, when he took them with him, they would announce his presence wherever he went. Now the prophet Samuel, as you recall, had predicted that this would be the kind of behavior that King Saul would exhibit, but I think he was also prophesying about what would happen during this time. In 1 Samuel 8, 11, the Lord said to Samuel, and he said, this is the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. Again, he's doing the very same thing that Saul did. And Moses warned against the acquisition of horses. And again, I've shared this with you before. For any king, that was something that they were not to do, because they were not to trust in the implements of warfare, but to trust in God. It says in verse 17, verse 14 through 16, when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from whom among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You shall not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Again, David would write in Psalms 20 and verse 7, some trust in horse, or some trust in chariots, and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. That was David's heart. Now, since David was not available to the people, again, probably because of an illness, Absalom met them while they were on the way to the city gate to have their grievances heard. And probably David had a deputy of some kind there to judge the things that they were bringing before the king's representatives. But again, notice he wasn't judging at the gate. Absalom was not judging at the gate. He was standing on the way to the gate and beside the road, basically. Now, the city gate was like the city hall in ancient times. Usually every city, that's where they would conduct courts and things like that. Absalom knew people were becoming disgruntled and they were not satisfied with what was going on with the kingdom. And they were wondering why the justice court system wasn't functioning efficiently. It was probably because the king was ill. He wasn't there. Somebody else was doing it. After Absalom was killed, look what Joab said to David in 2 Samuel 19, verse 5 through 6. And Joab came to the house, into the house to the king and said, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life. It's because David's mourning for his son. The lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants, for today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Now therefore arise and go out and speak comfort to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, no one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. Then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told all the people, saying, there is a king sitting in the gate. And so the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. So this kind of gives us the impression that David was not there holding court. Absalom would, again, greet these visitors like old friends and find out where they came from and talk about what their problems were. And most of the time he would agree that all their complaints were legitimate and that he would settle them in their favor if he was in the king's court. It was just a gross flattery that he was using with the people, and the people loved it. Isn't it funny? People love to be flattered, you know? It's like, we used to talk about, Natalie and I, about going and buying a car, you know, how the car salesman will use a lot of flattery. But she used to really irritate her whenever they didn't talk to her, they would just talk to me, because she felt like they need to talk to me too. But I know that when you go and talk to these car salesmen, they're trying to sell you a car, and they will butter you up. They will do whatever it takes. So Absalom, he boasted that he would handle the matter in favor if only he were judge. Again, this was a subtle way of criticizing his father and the fact that he wasn't allowing things to be done like they should be. When people started to bow to him because he was the crown prince, he would reach out his hand and stop them, and instead he would pull them to himself and kiss them. Again, this has to remind us of the hypocritical kisses of Judas, right? When he greeted Jesus in the garden, it wasn't sincere. It was only to endear himself to the people to make them think that he really cared. Boy, does this sound like a politician? And then this goes way back to who knows how long this has been going on, this kind of thing. Like even the kissing of babies, you know. Do you want to really go out and kiss every baby that's out there, you know? And they basically do it because they want people to know that you care, or at least perceive that you care. So it only took 4 years for Absalom's magnetism to draw together a large number of devoted followers throughout the whole land. But the people Absalom met returned home and told all their family and their friends and their neighbors that they had spoken personally with the crown prince and had received some assurances. And again, over that 4 years, This kind of an endorsement won Absalom many friends, and his rapid success at influencing the minds and hearts of the nation warns us that one day there will be a leader who will arise who will control the minds of the people all around the world. Even the people of Israel will be deceived and will sign a peace treaty that will be brokered by this man. But he will eventually turn on them, just, you know, like anybody who's like Absalom would. In Daniel 9, verse 26 through 27, it says, "After 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary." Now, one of the things that I think where people get it wrong here is they say, well, this is talking about Rome, because this happened, you know, with when the Roman Empire came on the scene, the prince who was to come. I honestly believe that the people, it says, the people of the prince who is to come really speaks of the Antichrist, but the prince who is to come is the prince of the power of the air, the Satan himself, who will be incarnate in a human body. And it says that to the end of it shall be with a flood until the end of the war, of the war desolations are determined, and when he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offerings. On the wings of oblation shall one make, shall be the one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate. Remember, Jesus said, he cried for Jerusalem. He said, "Behold, your house is left to you desolate, and you won't see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes upon the name of the Lord.'" And this time of Jacob trouble, the enemy, the Antichrist, is going to come on the scene, and many of the Jewish people will accept him, but there will be those that do not. And to those who accept him, again, they're going to realize that he's going to turn on them, and they're going to suffer great affliction. Daniel 11, verse 31 through 33, 31 through 37 says, "And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation." Now, again, you look at many Bible scholars will say this is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a Seleucid king, a Syrian king, and this is one of the reasons why the Antichrist is called the Syrian, because it happened once, but history is going to repeat itself. So if we shared with you before in the book of Matthew, it says, when you see the abomination of the desolation standing in the holy place, it says, and then in parentheses it says, "Let he who reads this understand," and it says, "Then flee to the mountains." So, in other words, well, the point is that it's going to happen again. "Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery," just like Absalom did. Absalom's really kind of a picture of the Antichrist. He's the one who's trying to usurp the throne, and just as this Antichrist will try to usurp the throne from Christ. "But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits." Isn't that a kind of a cool verse of scripture? Good to know. "And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue." That kind of gives you the, you know, the impression that right at first, when the enemy goes against not only the Jewish people who have the testimony of Jesus Christ, but all who have the testimony of Jesus Christ, that nobody will stand with him, at least at the beginning, but later on, because people realize that their lives are in jeopardy as well, perhaps they get involved then. "And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them and purify them and to make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done." In other words, the tribulation, time of Jacob's trouble, until it's all accomplished. "And he shall regard neither the God of his father, nor the desire of women. And again, a lot of Bible scholars believe that the desire of women was to, the women wanted to be the mother of the Messiah, you know. But I think it's more likely that it's talking about the fact that this man will probably be a homosexual, didn't have a desire for women, nor regard any God, for he shall exalt himself above them all. I remember Jesus said in John 5, verse 43, I come in my Father's name, and you did not receive me. If another comes in his own name, him you will receive. And this is exactly what will happen. And that's what Absalom is a type and a shadow, a picture of. Now, Absalom had been deceiving his siblings and the whole Jewish nation for years. But when the right time came, again, he made that bold move and basically lied to his father. The prince no longer was under house arrest, so there was no need for him to get permission to leave Jerusalem. Again, I think he did so to allay any fears that might arise because of Absalom's former feast, which he had with Amnon, in which he killed Amnon. So to give credit to the 200 key people in David's administration who went with them and willingly attended his feast, these men, they went along without knowing what Absalom was about to do. And the people, these 200 important people, you know, basically they impressed them that Absalom had this connection with these 200 important people. And the fact that this trip was connected with Absalom's vow gives it kind of the aura of a religious assembly as well. Sacrifices were offered, and you've got to think, well, what in the world could go wrong at a feast that was basically dedicated to the Lord? But Absalom had no intention of doing that. Absalom was using the name of the Lord to hide his sins. Again, this man of sin that comes on the scene may do the very same thing. He will use those flatteries to come in. But Absalom's mastermind was also to win the support of Ahithophel. He was David's, basically his smartest counselor. And when the guests saw him at the feast, they probably felt confident that all was well, as you know, because, all was well because he was there. Ahithophel did more than attend the celebration, though. He actually joined Absalom in revolting against David. And again, as we've shared before, it's probably because Ahithophel, he was the grandfather of Bathsheba, and again, he no doubt held a grudge against him because of what he did with Bathsheba and killing her husband as well. So it was probably Ahithophel who was actually one who masterminded this whole rebellion. Again, this was a chance to avenge himself on David. However, in supporting Absalom, Ahithophel was rejecting Bathsheba's son Solomon, who God would choose to reign in David's place. And at some time, he was taking steps that would lead to his own death. And he would do what Judas did, if you recall. He hanged himself, and he went out and hung himself because of his betrayal. David wrote in Psalms about him, a couple of them actually, in Psalms 41 and 9, he said, even my own familiar friend whom I have trusted, who ate my bread, has lifted up his heel against me. We know in the New Testament, Jesus uses this to describe Judas, as well as Psalm 55, verse 12 through 14. For it is not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it, nor was it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me, then I could hide from him. But it was you, a man my equal, my companion and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked into the house of God in the throng. And so what we see here is David, his one somebody he considered a good friend and a trusted counselor, was going to deceive him. And at the same time, because he rejected God's chosen one, he was sinning against the Lord. So why did Absalom decide to start this insurrection in Hebron? And for one thing, it was the former capital of Judah. And maybe there were people there who resented David for moving the capital to Jerusalem. But Absalom was also born in Hebron and could claim a special kinship to the people. Hebron was also a sacred city to the Jews because it was assigned to the priests and to the Levites, and it had a connection with Caleb, one of the heroes of the faith. And this was spoke about in Joshua 21, verse 8 through 16. And the children of Israel gave these cities with their common lands by lot to the Levites, as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses. And so they gave from the tribes of the children of Judah and from the tribe of the children of Simeon these cities, which are designated by name, which were for the children of Aaron, one of the families of the Kohathites, who were of the children of Levi, for the lot was theirs first. In other words, they didn't receive an allotment of land as much as they did. They received cities. And they gave them Kirjath Arba, the father of Anak, which is Hebron, in the mountains of Judah, with the common land surrounding it. But the field of the city and the villages they gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as his possession. Thus to the children of Aaron, the priest, they gave Hebron with its common land, a city of refuge for the slayer. In other words, it was a refuge. If somebody killed somebody accidentally, they could flee to the city and be protected from the avenger of the blood, the slayer, you know, and they would be safe until he would be safe after the high priest died. He was to be set free. And it says, Libna was with its common land, Jatir with its common land, Eshtimoa with its common land, Halon with its common land, Debir with its common land, and Ain with its common land, Juta with its common land, and Beth Shemesh with its common land, nine cities from those two tribes. And all of those were cities of refuge. So Hebron was, again, located about 20 miles southeast of Jerusalem. It was a walled city, and it was ideal to launch an invasion against Jerusalem from, and the place where he would end up seizing the throne. With 200 of David's officials imprisoned behind Hebron's walls, it would be simple for Absalom to take over the kingdom, because the people would be convinced that these 200, no doubt, were siding with Absalom. Verse 13 through 15 says, Now the messenger came to David, saying, The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And so David said to his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, Arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. And the king's servant said to the king, We are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. So Absalom and Ahithophel had their trumpeters and messengers ready to act at the signal. The word spread quickly throughout the land. Absalom is king. He reigns in Hebron. This anonymous messenger who came to David basically saved David's life here. Again, we don't know if David was really ill or sick or something. Whatever, he was lethargic before this all happened, and when he heard about it, he immediately moved into action. And he could clearly see that the handwriting was on the wall and that he had been played by his own son. But the thing about David is he always did his best work during crisis. And David knew that because Absalom killed Amnon, he was likely to kill all of the brothers as well, all of his other sons. This was common practice with a lot of the kings of Israel and Judah. And he believed that he would probably kill David himself. But also the fact that David knew if Absalom attacked Jerusalem, he would slaughter many of the innocent inhabitants of Jerusalem. And he saw no reason for the hundreds of innocents to be killed. And so David lovingly left and took his people with him, so that basically Absalom just rode in there without a fight and took the throne. It's amazing, as we watch what's going on in the news right now, particularly with the Democrat Party, and we see how that Joe Biden has dropped out, and now there's a big fight. Who is going to, I'm going to use this term, take the throne of the Democrat Party, and ultimately take the throne of the United States. There's a lot of conspiracy, intrigue, all of those things. There's nothing new under the sun, is there? Again, we look at Absalom. He was a good-looking man, but he was a horrible individual. You know, you can't think for a moment. Yes, maybe he was justified for being angry what his brother did to his sister, but killing him, you know? I mean, if you love your brother, I mean, certainly there should be a place for forgiveness, you know? But at the same time, you know, like I said, he exhibited what kind of man he was by all the intrigue, the flattery, and ultimately usurping the throne of his father. And again, as I said, it's all a type and a shadow, a picture of what's to come. Any questions or thoughts? Yeah. He's patient. Yeah. What kind of wicked heart do you have to be able to wait that long without having some kind of conviction, you know? Yeah.